Welcome to the second podcast in the new series, Future Proof Your Career. My name is Elise Stevens, and today I have the fabulous Andy Kaufman. Andy Kaufman, or Andy, is a recognized expert on leadership and project management, helping organizations around the world improve their ability to deliver and lead. Andy works with leaders at the United Nations and other global clients to improve their ability to deliver on their initiatives. Before becoming an international sought-after speaker, Andy started as a software developer and was promoted into management for all the wrong reasons. He is the author of three books and host of an acclaimed People and Projects podcast, which provides free PDUs through interviews and insight for his global listeners. Hello, Andy. How are you?
Well, Elise, it is great to be on your podcast. It is, you know, I've been a big fan of Elise for quite a long time, and we've had some chats off on the side, and so it's wonderful to be able to join your podcast. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm a bit of a fangirl of yours, Andy, as well. It's the Mutual Fan Society.
Yeah.
Today, we're talking about how to effectively deal with difficult people or people that we perceive as being difficult.
That's actually a good clarification you make on that one, because I think... Like, for example, I like to say that one of the best bosses I ever hated to work for was a difficult boss. But in retrospect, I learned so much from that boss. So I perceived them to be difficult. The truth was I had to grow a lot under them. So that was, I love how you actually clarify that.
What is it? One man's something is another man's something else. Sorry.
Yeah. No, but it's true. Like one person's bully is the other, not given any ground for someone who's truly a bully. But I think sometimes we're faced with a difficult person and we might write them off as a bully, but the truth is they're a difficult person, you know? And so the way we look at it can make all the difference. That's what I like about how you position that.
It is. And it is how you perceive, how you interact. It could be at that moment in time. And it's also sometimes how you put your own mindset spin on it.
Right.
And of course, there are just the truly toxic bosses out there. Let's not sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, first question. We all need strategies to effectively deal with difficult people or people we perceive to be difficult.
Yeah.
What are some of the most effective ways to manage difficult people?
Yeah, I suppose it's fair to say right up front that it's easy for you and I to talk about easy solutions to more complex problems. So it is, I think, maybe good to get it out there just by saying that. So even as we're having this discussion, it might be interesting for people as they're listening to visualize who that is in their world right now. Because, I mentioned a boss. It might be a difficult boss. It might be a difficult stakeholder. It could be a client. There could be all kinds of different things. But one way I find that to keep this a little less out of the realm of theory and a little bit more practical is for people to be thinking about who that might be in their world right now. And so one thing that I would like to suggest is for the difficult people, for them, a strategy, is there's something about cognitively reframing them as a challenge instead of writing them off as an idiot or they're just an obstacle or something like that. There's something about reframing that. And let me give you an example of that. You and I spend time in front of audiences or workshops. We spend time with people and every once in a while there's somebody there. I mean, usually people are like motivated to learn and they want to do it. But I was working with a group of flight attendants, and I don't know if this is completely fair to say, but some might say that that's a difficult population to work with in that there's a lot of demands on flight attendants, a lot of hours, there's the physical stress, there's the customer service side of it. And so it was an interesting group to work with. But anyway, there's a guy off on my left, and it was pretty clear from the beginning of the workshop, it was a leadership workshop, and it's pretty clear he was going to be a prop because he was just like, oh, that's a stupid idea. And oh, this is, so he had a lot of concerns. And so I tried every facilitation trick I know, at least, to try to deal with it. Nothing was working. So here's what I found. Take it as a challenge. There's something about we can write off that boss, but if someone's going to sit back and wait for a boss to retire or get fired or whatever, they're going to have a lot of birthdays. So instead of hoping that the problem goes away, I think there's something about cognitively reframing it as this person's a challenge, which keeps us curious then of like, what would it take to crack them? Let's say, what would it take to change things? So anyway, in my example, during that workshop, during a break, I just went up to him and this is what I said. Do you ever wonder about when someone's complaining about their job? All I said to him was like, why do you stay? Have you ever wondered that sometimes when people are complaining? Well, like, why do you stay? So anyway, he gave me that kind of like confused dog look where he kind of tilted his head and he's like, huh. And then he started giving all kinds of reasons of why he stays at his job. And you know what it became apparent is he loves his job. He hated his company. And so here I was, somebody from the outside. And I think what he was concerned was, is that this person from the outside is, you know, doesn't understand how miserable my job is. And so the take it as a challenge strategy would say there's always a reason behind human behavior. And though we may not agree with it, to them, the way that difficult stakeholder is working is completely reasonable to them. And you and I might not even agree. We might not think it's reasonable, but to them it is. So there's something about taking it as a challenge. Let me give you one more example specific to project management. I have a friend who, he took a really good project management job. He was in a good project management job, took a program management job, a really good one, good company. And it was in his first week, he had to present to the governance group. And there was somebody on the governance group who just started ripping into him, like yelling at him, disrespectful, swearing at him. And it was almost like one of those things of like, hey, who hired this person? Is he still on probation? Can we get rid of him? Like, what an idiot. How can you not know this? I mean, like, truly toxic. I mean, there's no way to rationalize around that the person was just difficult. I mean, they were like truly toxic. And what my friend went to say was, I don't even know where the men's room is yet. I mean, give me a week, you know, but he tried to take it as a challenge. And so he, you know, did a little bit more research about his projects and programs and things like that. And the second week, same thing. This guy just rips into him. And so, this is a rhetorical question for you and I, but at least answer this. What do you think? I mean, have you ever had someone shake your confidence? Boss?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it happens to us all, you know, and all of a sudden we start wondering, man, maybe I don't have what it takes, you know, for this. Anyway, that's where he was at. So in addition to take it as a challenge, a strategy can be do your homework. So like, do your homework on this person. I'm going to say that this person's name was Bob. Okay. So he started doing some asking some people, not in a gossipy sort of way, but just asking, hey, can you tell me about Bob? You know, and so somebody that he talked to said, you had to present to Bob. And they're like, and he said, yeah. He goes, and you lived? He goes, well, barely. And as it turns out, Bob treats everybody this way. Whether you're there for 2 weeks or whether you've been there 20 years, this is how Bob operates. He calls it a murder board, okay? And he thinks that that's a good idea, which maybe in 1960 might have been appropriate. I don't know. Probably not. But certainly current, no. But once my friend figured out that the way Bob was reacting was not necessarily personal to him, still bad, still inappropriate, still should be a trip to HR. But when he realized it wasn't necessarily personal to me, then he could act differently around it. It was a little bit easier to not take it quite as personal. I hopefully, at least you and I and any of the people listening will never have to deal with the Bobs out there. And it does beg the question, why do companies keep the Bobs, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, that's a different question.
It is. Yeah. So anyway, the take it as a challenge. Do your homework. Try to find out a little bit more. Yeah, maybe if I was to share one more strategy, if that's cool. I learned this from Amy Cuddy. She's the former Harvard professor, best known for the superhuman pose. You know, like if you're gonna try to build your confidence, you know, do your superhuman pose every day. And I passed this scenario by her. Like, let's say you've got a really difficult stakeholder. You have to go into a meeting with them. Like, what do you do? And she said, well, you can do your superhero poses or whatever. I don't know. But she also said there's some interesting research on affirmations. affirmation. She goes, here's the affirmation that doesn't work. I'm smart. I'm good looking. And people like me. She goes, that doesn't work so well. But she goes, here's an affirmation that does work. I know my stuff. I've done my research on this project or whatever it is. The company did put me in this position. So they have some faith in me on this. If a question comes up and I don't know it, I'll tell them I don't know, but I'll find out. So really what she was saying is speak truth to them. Actually, speak truth to yourself. And I think a lot of people struggle. I think this is both men and women. I think there's times where we're setting ourselves up in front of these difficult people to make it worse by the way we're talking to ourselves. Of like, oh, they're going to make me look like an idiot. They're out to get me, whatever. It's like, wait, real quick. How do I talk to myself about this? So Amy's advice is just speak truth to yourself. And the truth is, this project is not perfect. I will not know the answer to every question, but I do know answers to a lot of questions. And the questions I don't know, I will find out. And I deserve to be in this room. You know, things like that. So I think Amy's advice is good. And then a guy named Dr. Nick Morgan, CNN often brings him in after presidential debates to read body language and things like that. So this year should be fun. Nick said, here's an idea. He goes, if you're going to go into a meeting with a really difficult stakeholder, he says, sit down right next to them. Okay. So what do you think about this, ladies? Because a lot of times what we want to do is go to the other side of the room and give them as little eye contact as possible. So what do you think, just your gut feeling? Like, what would be an advantage of, you know, sitting down right next to that difficult person?
It's a good tactic. I will share one of my experiences. So I worked for someone that was quite challenging. I didn't like working for him at all. I thought he was a rude word. And so I was stressed. I was having the most horrible time. There was a whole lot of crap going down and I was just like, ugh. Anyway, long story short, it wasn't a great environment. I was stressed and so I was unhappy. But then I started working out that I just started being super nice to this person and it really used to piss him off. So he'd call me in for a meeting into his office. I'd go in, I'd trudge in, and I go, oh, hi, how's it going? How are the kids? You know, how's kindy going for your little one? Oh, that's good. You know, oh, that must be so hard. Oh, blah, blah, whatever. Whatever stuff I could think of to not talk about what we were really going to be talking about. And you see, it just neutralized him because he'd be ready to go for the jugular at me. And I'd be, you know, doing all this engaging stuff. And so then you could see it in his face that he was annoyed at me because I was talking to him about this stuff and asking him questions. And then he was so... He really didn't know what to do. So anyway, long story short, the relationship never really got better, but he got moved on. And then I went to work for someone else that wasn't as bad as him. I understood her a lot better. Anyway.
Well, no, it's actually a good story though, because it's kind of along those lines. Like, let's say you get there early in the meeting and you sit down right next to them. You could pull out, you know, hashtag be like Elise. You could just, you know, pull out that strategy and just, hey, you know, how was your weekend? You know, just pull it out. And I think for some people, that's going to annoy the daylights out of them. Like, it'll make them uncomfortable that you're not afraid of them. And this is what I really like, especially when I'm working with coaching clients who are women. Sometimes that really difficult man can feel very intimidating. Just go sit down right next to him. Right next to him. And really what you're saying is, I mean, I'm not afraid of you. It's a little bit like the from the Art of War, the Sun Tzu line of keep your friends close and your enemies closer. Yeah, it's because when you sit down right next to them, it's called proxemics. The distance you are from someone will impact how they act. And so, for example, if somebody goes, you know what? I'm so sick of that person. I'm not even going to go to that meeting. Right? Well, that difficult stakeholder is going to say all kinds of things about you or your project. But if you're in the room, it's different. And if you're sitting right next to them, it's different. And so, and if for no other reason, you can at least address anything that they say. But I find,
I was thinking annoy them, but anyway.
Well, yeah. But if nothing else, I really like the idea of sometimes we let these difficult stakeholders get to us. And
yeah.
Now Nick says this, Nick Morgan guy, the guy who said like sit right next to them. He also talks about how, you know, take up space and keep your head higher than the other person. That starts to get, you know, kind of medieval at that point. But I think there's something about just saying, I'm not afraid of you, not in some sort of thump my chest sort of way, but just, you know, in a at least kindness sort of way of like, yeah, I'm not afraid of you. Because I think what happens is these difficult stakeholders, we let them get to us. And Nick's point is we start to contract and we start to look weak. And to some people, that's blood to a shark. You know, they love that smell. Oh, I'm getting to her. I'm getting to her. And you, in your example, you didn't let him get to you, you know? In fact, it was somewhat the other way around. So I like that idea because I think left to our own devices, we will go sit on the other side of the room. And I think Nick would also say that if you're sitting right next to them, it shows there's a we, not a us versus them. You know, like if you're on the other side of the table, it's kind of like us versus them. I think there's some wisdom to that. I learned from a guy named Tim David. We had him on the podcast a while back. He wrote a book called True Influence, something like that. And he goes, people become difficult when their needs are not being met. So that can be an interesting thing to keep in mind. That difficult person, like I'm not trying to figure out if they have mommy or daddy issues from a young age. So I don't know what their needs are. But one of the things he followed that up with was, if you don't know any better, assume that their needs are to be listened to, appreciated, and loved. Now, I'm not too worried about loving the Bobs. I'm not too worried about that. But the listen to is an interesting one of that difficult person. There may be the reason why they're ramping it up with the energy is they feel like I'm not listening, and maybe I'm not. Can I give you one more strategy? This is a crazy one. So this comes from a guy named Dr. Mark Goulston, and he's a clinical psychiatrist. And he wrote this book called Talking to Crazy, which I think is a hilarious title of a book, Talking to Crazy. He says this, like when, you know, when someone's ranting to you, at least they're going, and then like this and this. What's tempting to do when someone's ranting?
Oh, you turn off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You're somewhere else in the conversation. You're like, oh, you're finished.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Maybe looking at my watch, looking away, you know, things like that. And maybe we're not saying, you're an idiot. Like maybe we're not saying that, but our body language can ooze. You're an idiot, right? Because it's what we're thinking often is oozing out of us. Yeah. So this is what Mark says, and this is going to sound absolutely crazy, but he said, you know, like if someone is if they are out fishing, like I'm not a big fisher person, but let's say you're out fishing and you get a big fish on the line. I don't know. Do you go fishing at all? At least do you fish? Yeah. No. Anyway, you get a big fish on the hook. What are you supposed to do? Well, after you set the hook, you're supposed to just let the fish run a little bit so it gets tired out and it's easier to bring it in. So anyway, he says the equivalent of that is, and here's the crazy part. When that person is ranting, stare in their left eye. Okay. Now, it sounds creepy. It sounds weird. And he goes, it's not perfect science that the left eye is tied to the right brain, but what it does is it keeps you giving eye contact. And as crazy as it sounds, I probably use it almost every week, sometimes with my kids. You know, they're telling me about something and maybe I'm just like, just keep eye contact, Dad. You know, like just keep eye contact. If nothing else, you're trying to signal, you're trying to show that you're listening. And I found no evidence of left eye versus right eye anecdotally, but I have found that keeping eye contact with that difficult stakeholder keeps me a little less from oozing, you're an idiot, yeah, shut up, you know, stuff like that. So I think it's a couple of interesting potential ways for people to look at and go, huh.
I don't know about you, Andy, but with my engagements with difficult people, it can actually take a lot out of me. And I end up being very stressed on situations. And How can we keep ourselves together during these situations?
Yeah, I'm thinking medication. No, actually, that's maybe so. But beyond that, this is one idea that I found is really helpful. And I learned it from a guy named Dr. Mike Roberto, who's a former Harvard Business School professor, now at Bryant University. We've had him on the podcast three times. And he had this book, what's it called? Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer. This is the name of it. Why Great Leaders Don't Take Yes for an Answer. It's a kind of a clever title. It's a lot of times people think that the boss just wants yes people around them. And it's about managing the tension between consensus and conflict, because too far in either end is going to be a problem. So anyway, it's a wonderful book in many ways. But one of the ideas that he talks about in his book, the difference between cognitive conflict and affective conflict. So he's an academic, so he has to use terms like that. But I found the distinction to be really, really helpful. For example, cognitive conflict would be about the idea, and affective is more where it's name calling. It's what Bob was in my earlier example. It's the way over the line of disrespect. Now, to your question about trying to keep it together, I don't know. In your growing up, Elise, would you say your family culture was conflict was out in the open and a lot of it, or would you say it was kind of like, any conflict was bad, or how would you say you grew up thinking about conflict?
I think that there were a lot of dynamics in the family happening, and later, much later, my parents ended up getting divorced, mm-hmm. When I was in my 20s. So I think that whilst I was growing up, there was all this stuff.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so that informs kind of how you look at conflict. Same on my side. Mine was a little bit different in that it was more of like any conflict is bad and kind of a little bit behind closed doors. And so I didn't learn how to really look at conflict in a productive way. And I suppose every family is dysfunctional to some degree. But I look at, while I was dating my wife, they call themselves Jewish Italian. They're neither. But they're like right over dinner, they're having this massive fight. And by dessert, everyone's fine. And I'm just like, what just happened here? Like, takes me 2 weeks to get over it, But so I grew up kind of feeling like any conflict is bad. And so Mike Roberto's cognitive versus affect has been so helpful for me with difficult stakeholders. The idea of cognitive, it's about the idea. And so what this has helped me with, and I would hope it'd be helpful for the listeners as well, is sometimes what happens is someone questions us or someone takes a contrarian opinion and we take it as conflict. Like, who do they think they are? How dare they say that? Something like that. But it might actually be just cognitive conflict. Like, maybe they didn't mean it disrespectful. They didn't mean it to be difficult. It's a genuine misunderstanding, or they're trying to find, do they agree? And so what Mike would say in his book, or actually does say in the book, is cognitive conflict is good and necessary. And if you don't have some of that on your team, that may not be a good sign. It might be a sign that people don't even care. In fact, right now, even as we're having this conversation, I hope some listeners are like, I don't know if I agree with that stare in the left eye thing. That's cognitive conflict. That's not saying, Andy, you're an idiot. And maybe some people are thinking that too. That's okay. But the point is, difficult stakeholders, it could be that what's going on is cognitive conflict, but we're treating it, we're reacting as if it's affective conflict, like it's a personal threat. And I don't know what it's like in Australia, but I got to tell you, in the US right now, we are so easily offended. Like, so easily offended. Oh my goodness. Yeah. You say this. Oh, I'm disrespected and I'm oppressed. And so I'm not saying that oppression doesn't happen. I'm not saying disrespect doesn't happen. And Twitter's a cesspool and there's all kinds of people yelling at each other. So I get it. But understanding the difference between cognitive and affective has been so helpful for me, because I've been on like a 6-year mission to not be easily offended. And I would ask others to join in this mission. Don't be easily offended. When someone gives you that difficult stakeholder, gives you feedback on the project, or they don't agree with you on something, even if you have to suspend disbelief, try to take it as cognitive, not affective. Try to take it, even if they maybe in your heart of hearts think you think they mean it insulting, try not to take it that way. Try to take it as it's cognitive. And I learned this from a guy named Peter Bagassian. He wrote a book, How to Have Impossible Conversations was the name of the book. Peter's just, he's a wonderful guy. He's a troublemaker, man. There's a long story behind Peter, but this How to Have Impossible Conversations, if I don't get this quote exactly correct, it's really close to it. He says, if you have to make an assumption about someone's intentions, assume they are better than what you think. And so I don't know, Elise, I found that so helpful because when someone doesn't agree with me, it's so easy to jump to, they have bad intentions. They're trying to throw me under the bus. You know, it's affective. So I would say his book, to your point, how do you keep it together? His book would suggest stay deeply curious. Stay deeply curious. So how do I keep from just losing it? Try, and it's a lot easier to talk about than it is to do it, but try to be like, first of all, they may have a point. I mean, it might be cognitive conflict, but I wonder why they think that, and ask clarifying questions. And he's like, don't litigate. Don't be a lawyer. Don't litigate, but just ask clarifying questions. You have to try to understand, and you might just uncover something. So just one last example on this one. I had a listener from somewhere in Europe, and he sent me an email. He goes, I hate the sound of your podcast. I'm like, what I felt like saying was, well, there's thousands of others that don't mind it. But I was like, no, stay curious. Like, what is it? What is it? And I'm like, was it one particular episode? He goes, no, it's all of them. So I'm like, oh, great. Great. But once again, stay curious. Like, tell me more. Anyway, he turns out this guy's some like audio expert. He sends me like these wave, you know, something. I didn't even understand him. But he goes, you're over compressing during post-production. I'm like, well, I actually am using some compression. And so anyway, I started changing some things. And I didn't tell him. But after like three or four episodes, I got back to him and go, hey, by the way, I made some changes. Is it any better? He goes, yeah, but I didn't want to say anything to you to make you cocky. I'm like, okay. So, all right. So, you know, he could probably brush up his, you know, his warmth a little bit, but here's the deal. And I fail at this far more than I'm even telling you. I'm sure I could give you endless number of stories of how I fail at this, where I go straight to assuming it's affective instead of cognitive. And I don't stay curious, which is probably the majority of the time, at least. But in this case, by staying curious, the podcast sounds a lot better. In fact, based on the tools I've learned from you, the podcast is going to sound better. But the thing is, if we don't stay open-minded, if we don't stay curious, it's really difficult to learn from it. And so as difficult as that person is, what if we said, maybe it's cognitive, maybe it's not affective, maybe their intentions are better. Ask some questions. Take a deep breath. How can I think of it as a challenge? Stare at their left eye, you know, but it's try to not take it personal. Try. And some people, they're just toxic. Some people, they're just not worth the effort. And we just write them off and separate as much as we can from them. But sometimes it's those difficult people that might just be helping us end up being a little bit better.
And I think that what you said is, like, all that's great advice, but for me, the number one thing that I struggle with is not taking things personally. And so I have got better at this through my own approach. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, I'm always trying to make sense of situations, mm-hmm. kind of like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
You know, what's going on? And you know, I admit that when I, even if a situation's difficult, if I understand where it's coming from, yeah. I can deal with it a lot better. It's that I think that, you know, 80% of the people, it's an idiosyncrasy thing, like Bob and his murder panel.
Yeah, right.
Or murder group or whatever he calls it. Uh-huh. Well, everyone gets that, and it's like, well, I'm not special, I can move on kind of thing, and, you know, I can come up with different strategies. But I think that one of the things that I've learned over the years is that, you know, when someone's being difficult and they've got an agenda, mm-hmm. and you don't understand that agenda. And so I spend way too much time trying to work out what the real story is. But once I understand it and I understand what's going on, or I understand that they're a particular personality type, or when they're in stress mode, they go to a particular type of actions or requirements, then you can understand it and you're like, okay, I understand this, I can move forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's the once. And then I can divorce it.
Mm-hmm.
So good at, I understand that she's like this.
Mm-hmm.
Understand now why she's doing X, Y, and Z. Fine, move on. It's the ones that don't make sense, and it's only with the fullness of time that you understand what was going on. And you're right, as difficult as it is, you do learn from these situations. Like, you know, it takes a heavy toll upon yourself and you get very stressed and you've got to try and pick yourself up and move forward. I think that the more times, unfortunately, that you encounter these things, the more you can treat it as like a clinical experiment and divorce yourself.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good way of saying it, that I feel like it's almost so cliche to say it's the challenges that build resilience, but it's true. Like that really difficult boss I started out by talking about, like that boss really toughened me up. I didn't enjoy probably a single day reporting to that boss, but I am so much better. And after years of therapy, but I'd be like after some distance of time, what I realized is they were a gift to me. And once again, we're not leaving any room for Bobs out there. No, but that difficult stakeholder, maybe there's something we can learn from them there. You know, maybe.
But the reality is that we're always going to encounter difficult people in our lives. Yeah. For example, out here, we're in the middle of COVID-19 at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so where I live in Queensland, Australia, you know, we've got no masks. We're fine mm-hmm. at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we can go about our business. Life is normal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Another state, Victoria, they've had a hotspot. You know, they're getting 300 cases a day or something at the moment. And they're hopefully that's their peak. But for certain areas in some of the cities in Victoria, they've mandated that people wear a mask.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty reasonable. But there are these people saying, no, it's whatever.
Yeah.
And they're arguing with the police about wearing a mask. And, you know, you don't have the right to arrest me. And the policeman's going, yes, I do. Yeah. Because you're not obeying I don't agree with this. And he goes, I'm not debating whether you agree with the law or not. But it's like, you're just feeling saying, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
What? Really?
No, that's actually a really good example. We're wrestling with that in the States as well. But here's an interesting kind of thing about that is if you are a masker or a non-masker, let's just call them, you know what happens is we tend to hang out with all, if you're a masker, you hang out with masker people. And if you're a non-masker, you hang out with non-maskers. And so it almost builds up this, we are right. We are right. And they're all a bunch of idiots. And, I learned this from, she's a professor over at the London School of Business, Herminia Ibarra. She's just a brilliant woman. She wrote a book called Act Like a Leader, Think Like a Leader. And she's like episode 130 or something like that. And she had this line that said, left to our own devices, we build networks that are narcissistic and lazy. Narcissistic means we hang out with people who are like us, lazy, just easy people to hang out with. And maybe part of building our resilience around difficult people is we try to spend time, at least some time, trying to, if you are a non-masker, you know, build some relations up with people who do wear it and why they feel that way. And almost always what you find is there's more nuance to someone's position than what we want to think. Yeah. Yeah, there's more nuance. They've got an old parent, aging parent that's in a nursing home that is very ill. Like, I mean, there's often more nuance to people's positions. But you know what we do? We're like, you're an idiot, or you know, you're like me, or you're, you know, we just write people off. And that may be just distinctly American. I don't know, but I think that's culturally the polarization in a lot of cultures right now is such like that. So I don't wake up in the morning and say, I can't wait to deal with a difficult person today, at least. Like, that's not me. But when I do run across somebody, I'm trying more often now. And whether it's maybe on a certain day, maybe it feels like it's my wife's the difficult person or my kid's a difficult person. Maybe I'm arguing with myself, for goodness sake. I don't know. But it's the wait a minute. Like, I think of Ruth, our mutual friend, Ruth Pierce, about her focus on mindfulness of like, well, what am I feeling like right now? Like, what is that? What's that from? You know, and really trying to just stay open-minded to why am I feeling this? I'm starting to believe, in some ways at least, that curiosity is the ultimate hack. If we can just stay curious, if we can just stay like, huh, what is that? Why would that person not want to wear a mask? Why would they feel like that's a violation of their own personal freedoms and stuff like that? And almost always we'll find it's more nuanced than what we want to think. So I found that to be helpful.
I think you do have to do a bit of delving into their psyche, as much as you don't want to rummage around sometimes. Andy, what tips would you give other people about effectively managing relationships with difficult people?
Favorite one is along the lines of what you did with your person. And I got it from, as far as just build relationship. So we had Dr. Robert Cialdini on the podcast back in episode, I think it was like 157 or something like that. But he's like one of the foremost writers and researchers on influence. And he has these six weapons of influence. And one of them is liking. And one of the things that he says is, there's a number of things he says about this, but you can more influence people if they like you. Now, this doesn't mean just go around and try to be desperately liked. You know, it's not that. There's plenty of that going on. But he has this one particular strategy underneath liking that I think is really interesting. He says for those really difficult people, you need more interaction with them, but under positive circumstances. So there's an element of which that was part of your story. Let me give you an example. The truth is my 19-year-old daughter is probably a little more of a daddy's girl than a mama's girl. So where's most of the conflict? With mom. And so one of the things that Cialdini says is you need more contact with that person, but under favorable situations. Don't talk about the points of contact of whatever is the conflict. So one of the things we learned is when she was a little bit younger, one of her, we could probably summarize her love language in one word, Frappuccino. Okay. So she just loved Frappuccino. So my wife would take her out and they'd get the largest Frappuccino and they'd get two empty cups and they'd divide those up. And according to my wife, they would not talk about any of the points of contention. So they wouldn't talk about boys or clothes or grades. I have no idea what they talked about. But for all I know, maybe they talked about boys and clothes. I don't know. But my daughter would come back so filled up from these. And so the kind of like the analog to that is that really difficult person that came to mind when we started this discussion today. Maybe what we need to do is be like you did with your difficult person. Spend more time with them, because think of the opposite. The opposite is we're going to spend as little time as possible. And then it's always this Pavlovian response. I see Andy, I start drooling and getting angry, you know, something like that. So if we can disassociate that and say, yeah, she's not so bad anyway. Like maybe I don't really agree with her, but the truth is Elise is a reasonable person. If we can build a relationship, more contact, but under favorable circumstances. So spend more time with them, like maybe go out for a cup of coffee, maybe go out to lunch, but don't talk about the project or about whatever it is the point of conflict. Cialdini says what that does is it builds up the relationship such that they just don't automatically write you off or their blood pressure go up just when they see you. So I was working with this with a coaching client and he, when I was telling him about this, he goes, take this person out to lunch. That'll be the best diet program ever. Like, I'll lose my appetite. Eh? Because we can think of people that are like that. But I'm just like, give it a try. Just give it a try. And he goes, you know what? We survived. And I was able to eat. And Cialdini's got this interesting line. He says, people don't buy from you because they like you. They buy from you because they know you like them. So it's a little bit of a twist to that. So around the really difficult people, it's try to find something that you like about them. Just something. Just like, you know, they wear clothes to work. I don't know what it is, but something that you like about them. Something that you can say that is honorable. They try to be a good parent, or they volunteer for some social cause. Whatever it is, you don't have to agree with it, but it's just like try to find something, because if not, like we talked about before, it oozes out of you. And so the best way I know to find something about them is to find, is there a bridge of similarity? Did they go to the same university? Do they have similar hobbies or social causes that they feel passionate about or something? And if you can find something, like we were both against wildfires in Australia. All right. So what is there something we agree upon? You know, is there something that we can agree upon? And if you can find those bridges of similarity, then sometimes that can help. And one last idea that Hermine Ibarra, the London School of Business professor, she says most of our relationships are backward looking. She goes, you got to be a lot more forward looking. So not just people we've worked with in the past that we connect with on LinkedIn or that we hang out with at work, be more forward looking. Like, who are relationships that I should be building, because that's going to be important in my future. So this is not about trying to elbow my way to the top and step on people on the ladder. It's not that. But it's like, when you look at projects you're going to be working on in the year or two ahead, like, who are some people? Like, that executive, I should probably get to know her a little bit better than what I do, because I'm going to need her sign off probably on some things. So just looking at relationship building, not as something you do to get a job, not as just something because like, oh, all right, I guess I should. You know, do it because relationship building is breathing. It should be breathing. It's not something you do. It's just who we are. We are relationship builders. That's what we are. We're not a project manager. We're not a manager. We're not a director. We are relationship builders. That's if we can look at it that way, that it's not an extra thing to do. It is breathing. It's what we have to do to be effective. I guess that's what I take, is just make it a part of every day.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. I think that just listening to what you were talking about, I also think that techniques like NLP and, you know, understanding where these people's perspective is, like, you know, the old DISC profiles and the strengths profiles, the VIA strengths, as Ruth Pierce has, or not has, but,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, advocate for, yeah.
And Myers-Briggs certainly give you tools that enable you to better understand where this person's coming from. So as an example, many years ago, I worked with a particularly difficult stakeholder, and he was very tricky, but I did understand what his, what he was trying to do. You know, he was empire building in his own way, right? Mm. And so you had to watch out, because you knew that he was empire building and that he would shit all over people,
yeah,
around the rest of the organization. But he was your key stakeholder on a number of projects. You had to find that balance. And yes, he was very tricky, very difficult to deal with. But once you understood that and understood what his objectives and goals were, mm-hmm, then you could better frame your conversations. And so he became less difficult. He was always challenging, and you never quite knew what you were going to get into. Understanding what's going on, and I think that that's an important thing to do.
That is good. There's a Brené Brown quote that I try to remember. I forget regularly, but she says, in the absence of data, we make up stories. And so I might make up some incorrect stories, you know, about things. So try to find data, you know, I like how you said that you like reposition how you interact with him. So you're not you know, this story is not the story might be like, he's trying to take me down. It may not be he's trying to take me down. He just doesn't want me to get in his way. And so it's like, how can I adjust it so I make it clear? Like, if it's a boss, I am for you. I am for you. I'm here to make you look good. You know, it's, and I don't mean it in some sort of manipulative way. Like, I want to make my boss look good. I really, really want to do that. So in our best moments, this is what we do, right? In the most difficult moments, it's why we're having conversations like this, to try to remember, maybe an extra tool or two to try. So,
yeah. And for anyone listening that's in the midst of bad situations with difficult stakeholders, be mindful. Spend time getting your own stuff together.
Yeah.
Exercise more.
There you go.
Meditate, yoga,
sleep,
do something that's going to help you get in a better space so that you can deal with this situation.
Yeah, that's really good advice, Liz. Yeah.
Well, Andy, love chatting with you as always.
You know, it is such a pleasure. Thank you for all you do to lift up the profession, and specifically women in the profession, and giving them a profile, a platform, and cheering people on by giving them examples to be inspired by. You inspire me in that way. So thank you, Elise.
Well, you inspire me. That ends another podcast from Future Proof Your Career.